Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about the crucial political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the challenges facing everyone. Good morning, folks. Steve Williamson here. This morning we have a guest really comes on. He's a Democratic Perspectives webmaster. So if you go to our website at www.bvid.org, you're going to find his work. He's the one who describes the show. He's the one who organizes the website. He's the one who produces it. Today we're going to talk about a topic that I think that we've never really reached before, maybe because the historical moment, Bill, is not been there. But the question is there a new left emerging? So in the 60s, there was the old left and a new left. And now something seems to be happening. And so what I want to talk with Bill about is there a difference between the sort of new left, people calling themselves socialists, and the broad movement, populist movement against Donald Trump and his presidency, which ranges all the way from establishment figures and conservatives — I've tried to get them on the show to talk about it, but haven't been lucky yet — to the far left. So is a new left emerging, Bill?
Well, the answer to that, of course, is not as simple as we'd like. The answer being yes. And no, but we've got.
Let's talk about the yes, and then we'll talk about the no.
Okay. Well, they're intertwined because we got history to deal with, right? I mean, all of these movements look toward the future, but they have their roots in the past. In a way, this is perfect timing for this show because the Democratic Socialists of America, which is the only overtly socialist political organization of any size in the United States, just finished up this weekend with its national convention in Chicago. So we're speaking to everybody here the day after this convention ended.
And they've tripled their membership. They started out with a huge 8,000 people, and now they're up to a big 25,000. Other organizations, say, for example, the Sierra Club, several million people, National Education Association, I think it's 3 million, and so forth. And Democratic Socialists have got 25,000 card-paying members. Yeah. But what is Democratic Socialism?
To answer that question, we have to look a little bit into history. To put things in perspective, DSA now claims that it's the largest explicitly socialist political organization in the United States since World War II. But, get this, at its peak in 1969, the Students for a Democratic Society, SDS, which was the classic new left organization that was called the new left in the 60s, had 100,000 members.
Well,
and America is no stranger to socialism. I mean, if you go back a little further, our 33rd vice president was a socialist, an open, avowed socialist, Henry Wallace.
I know that socialists in 1912 in Oklahoma, where I'm from, were the second largest political party, got the second largest number
that
of
was
votes.
That was the Socialist Party of America. And in 1912, their candidate for president, Eugene Debs, polled over 900,000 votes. He finished fourth out of a field of four, it's true. And but still, that's 900,000 people voted for a socialist in 1912, which, in our era, post-Cold War, that seems incredible. I mean, Americans have forgotten a lot of their history, mainly because not all of it is taught in schools. And
certainly labor history, as my co-host has always said, has kind of been buried. The whole history of the labor movement seems not relevant to a lot of people among Americans. So when we're talking about democratic socialism, we're obviously not talking about Stalinism or Maoism or even Castroism. We're talking about something else. What are we talking about?
Well, socialism is old, right? we're going to talk about the new left, but to do that, to put it in, you know, in context, we have to talk a little bit about, you know, how socialism got started. Socialism is as old as the United States Constitution. It's about 200 years old. The first mention of socialism in the English language comes about 1817 in the writings of Robert Owens, who was a Manchester cotton mill owner who got the socialist religion. He thought that capitalism was destroying people's lives, and so he took all the money that he made, and he made a lot of it as a cotton mill owner, and started funding intentional cooperative communities, and he called them socialist. So about 1820 or so.
So it doesn't start with Karl Marx, for example.
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, what was different about Karl Marx, we'll talk about a little later, but socialism, the idea that the new economic relations that were brought about by the Industrial Revolution were destroying people's culture, destroying their lives, began almost as soon as the cotton mills got going in northern England. The key insight of socialism was that you can't have democracy in the abstract. That is, your position in your economic position governed your freedom as an individual every bit as much as the political relationships that were written into constitutions or that had become over a period of time part of the traditions of the country.
So in the modern context, what this means is that you and I have a vote, and the Koch brothers each have one vote. But the Koch brothers have billions of dollars and have huge organizations, some of them quite secretive, to affect the election. And what we're seeing is it, let me ask you, Bill, is it connected with the increasing concentration of wealth in a few hands? Is that why we're beginning to see people call themselves socialist again, or are they really socialist in any old sense?
Well, let's stay where we were on track here for a minute, and then we'll get off of this historical stuff because the details are all available. People want to go and read about it. But the first mentions of socialism in reaction to the horrors that industrialization were visiting on the working class. Remember, these people had been peasants and they had established social relationships in their community. Then they were forced off the land and into the cities and put to work in factories where there are absolutely no rules govern their exploitation, except what the owners of the factories thought would make their work more profitable. And they didn't have much respect for these people, and they treated them horribly. You know, all the things we read about, black lung, child labor, 12-hour days, 7-day weeks, no benefits, no health care, wages that would barely provide enough bread to eat, let alone anything else. These were all features of early industrialization, and the reaction to it came almost immediately. But the idea was that the majority of people shouldn't be slaves simply because it was profitable or even progressive. I mean, industry increased productivity enormously in these countries. You know, these machines could make more sweaters in an hour than a weaver in a cottage in Scotland could produce in a month. That sort of thing, right? The division of labor. You know, I work all day at a machine and I just do one thing, but the total result is we can produce a lot more of the final product than we can if I make the whole thing myself, right? All of these advantages were true, but it also meant that all of a sudden, a huge percentage of the population had no real place in society anymore and no real income. And as a matter of fact, in the early days, they didn't even have the vote. The vote in England was until the Chartist movement in the 1830s. The vote was restricted to men of property. No women. And if you didn't own land, you couldn't vote. or you didn't own a factory, or you didn't own something substantial in terms of capital, you couldn't vote. So the reaction against this was that, hey, democracy doesn't mean anything if you give the vote to a population of slaves. So we have to govern the economic relationships as well as the political relationships in our society if we're going to have true democracy. That was the beginnings of socialism. That meant limits on the rights of the owners of capital. Okay? Marx comes along about 20 years later in the Communist Manifesto and says, no, we cannot, as individual people who make a living by our labor and have no other assets except our own physical labor, are never going to have the power to create a just society so long as the society has been run by people with huge amounts of money and huge amounts of power. You know, they control the armies, the police. They own all the stuff. We have to pay rent for everything. So what we need to do is to have a revolution. We need to take that property away from those people and manage it as a community. So that was revolutionary socialism. We can never disrupt these power relationships. They're too strong and we're too disorganized. We've got to organize ourselves as a working people's movement, take the stuff away from them and redistribute it. That was revolutionary socialism. You know, the democratic socialism just mainly wanted some reforms, what we call social democracy now. But they wanted reforms. They wanted votes for working people. They wanted,
40-hour work week.
40-hour work week. The 40-hour work week was part of the Chartist movement. 1830 was when they first asked for a 40-hour work week. And it took how long? It took 150 years to get that into a legislation in the United States. And
I believe that just having the women having the right to vote was almost a 150-year process of failure after failure until they finally succeeded.
Yeah. So, the early socialists, what they wanted was real democracy. That is, they wanted control of the economy, because without control of the economy, we're all going to wind up being wage slaves. The revolutionary socialist says you're not going to get it because the power relationships, the unequal power relationships can't be overcome. The oligarchs are too strong. So we need to just basically throw them out.
And kill them all, and we end up with communism in Russia and China and Cuba, and we end up with a production which some economists have estimated is about a third of the production of capitalism. So the Russian Revolution starts out so idealistic, and it declines into one of the most horrible governments in the history of the world.
Well, what you have is there was a famous book written by a Yugoslav author back in the 60s. It was called The New Class. His name was Milovangelis, for people who want to look it up, D-J-I-L-A-S. And he analyzed the Stalinist societies of Eastern Europe of the day. And what he said was, you haven't thrown out the capitalists and replaced them with honest working people. What you've done is you've created a bureaucracy where your access to power doesn't depend on property. It depends on your position in the Communist Party. But you have the same unequal power relationships in Soviet societies as you have in capitalist societies. And in fact, they're worse because there's no opposition. And so, and that's one of to move forward to the new left and the new left.
So let's just take a second. What you're saying is the whole idea of socialism is much older than people thought, also more complicated. And it's pre-Marxist. There's a lot of different people with a lot of different ideas about what this means. And what they're trying to confront, you're saying, as the central issue, is the fact of the accumulation of wealth in a few hands means that voting can have very little impact on what's going on in your society.
It means your democratic society's constitution can be subverted. You know, in our case, the First Amendment no longer means what the First Amendment meant. The Second Amendment doesn't mean what it used to mean. The Fourth Amendment is routinely ignored by government surveillance in the interest of national security, right? So anything down on paper has to be defended, and it can't be defended if the power relationships in the society based on wealth and access to wealth are so unequal. Because it's fairly easy to suppress mass social organizations if you have... you know, if you have real power in the society. I mean, look at China. There's no dissent whatever permitted in China. We're better off here because we have democratic traditions. But democracy is always under threat by people who, for reasons of their own, don't believe in it and are interested in accruing power so that they can have what they want and never mind what the masses of people need, because they, well, you know, Margaret Thatcher said it. There's a notorious Margaret Thatcher, the great friend of Ronald Reagan in the right-wing Britain. She said, there is no such thing as society. There's only individuals and families. Well, that's utter nonsense, but a lot of people believe it.
Certainly a lot of people in the United States believe it, and you get this sort of, before there's political fragmentation, there's the idea of the fragmentation. I mean, the whole libertarian movement is based on me first, basically only me, only what's interested me, not recognizing any of the contributions of an overall society. And the conservative view has become to mean it taps into a lot of American values of self-reliance. I mean, you and I both worked our whole lives and supported ourselves and so forth and so on. A lot of values, but it's been twisted and radicalized in a strange way. Where is democratic socialism going in all of this?
Well, let's proceed. New Left. Why was the New Left new? Well, because it came to into existence in the United States because of a couple of things. One was the Vietnam War, and the other was the threat to organized labor, to unions, the purge of leftists from national industrial unions that the AFL-CIO that took place under George Meany in the 50s. They threw out all the socialists because of the Cold War, because they were considered to be Russian sympathizers. And some of them, of course, were, because they mistook Stalin's supposedly revolutionary Russia for a socialist state when it was anything but. But so when these issues came to the fore, the draft, the Vietnam War, and so forth in the 60s, you already had some people in place who were interested in social democracy, like increased benefits for the working class. The Students for Democratic Society was an offshoot of the League for Industrial Democracy, which was a social democratic organization that had been around since the 30s. But their issues were youth issues. They were issues of the Vietnam War and so forth. But they thought of themselves, they didn't argue about economics, and they didn't argue about, you know, central planning as opposed to capitalism or any of that stuff, not at the beginning, because they didn't want to be associated with the old left that supported the totalitarianism of Stalinist regimes in Eastern Europe. So they called themselves the New Left, meaning the Democratic Left. They were very explicit. The SDS had a catchphrase. They called it participatory democracy. The only way to have real democracy is if everyone gets involved, the poor as well as the rich, the workers as well as, you know, what we call the bourgeoisie, the small property owners and administrators of the existing system. So they focused on the political demands of the left, and they they stayed away from the economic issues because if they got themselves involved in explicit criticisms of capitalism, they were going to be tarred as pinkos, right? So they tried to avoid that and still talk about issues of social justice, and that's what made them new, okay? They weren't, in fact, new. I mean, because the very first advocates of socialism had essentially the same platform.
We should take a moment to thank our sponsors, El Portal, great place to have breakfast, great place to stay, pet-friendly, incredibly, and also Door, Democrats of the Red Rocks, who has a really good speaker coming this month on, let me get the date for you guys, it's at 8 a.m. on August 17th. And it's Katie Hobbs, and she's going to be running for Secretary of the State. She's one of the most progressive, but also one of the most effective people in the legislature. And she's running that. She has a master's in social work. She was on the faculty of several colleges, and she's just done a bang-up job. So she's going to be speaking at Door at 8 o'clock on Thursday, third Thursday in the month, at August 17th. And we hope to have her interview her afterwards and put her on the show. So let's return to our question, Bill. So you've gone into the history of it. The idea of socialism, you told me one before the show, comes every time there's this kind of concentration of power in wealth. And so when you have the 50s, there's very little, nobody really cares about it that much. It declines. 60s, when people begin to feel that they don't actually control events like the Vietnam War, there's the civil rights movement.
No, I forgot to mention civil rights. That was a big thing. That got a lot of young people thinking about injustice. How can you have a democratic society and have Jim Crow?
Right.
How is that possible?
And so the new left starts out a lot when anti-racism, when the war comes along and bills that begin to get to be questioning the war. And, you know, and there was a time when nobody questioned the Vietnam War. You know, I remember my father supported it, kind of denouncing me for being against it. And then some years later, he said in front of his friend, he said, you were right about that war. That was not a good one. And he and all his friends and all my uncles and aunts and all your father all fought in World War II. And so when they saw a war, they just automatically supported it. And what the Democratic left did was actually look at the actual facts in Vietnam.
Yeah, the question was, is this really a defense of the United States and a defense of democracy? Or was it, you know, was it an attempt to retain control of the world economy by fencing in our only credible opponent, the Soviet Union?
Okay, so civil rights, democratic participation in the workplace, the new left in the 60s began to sense the lack of being able to control. It starts in the campus. They had in loco parentes. They had control of everybody. When I went to school in Oklahoma, they would not allow any real political organizations, even moderate liberal anti-communist groups were not allowed. The only thing were allowed were the major political parties. And so what was happening is you had a bunch of young people, first in college and then in business, bumping into all these restrictions.
And the contradictions that were associated with them. You know, we talked about democratic student government, but everybody knew that the student government was composed of toadies to the college administrations.
Part of the fight was to replace those guys. Now, so that's the 60s, all right? What are the central issues that, if there is a new left, and we'll go back to that, if there is a new left, what are its central issues now?
Yeah. Well, first of all, the demise of the new left of the 60s had to do really with the fact that the majority of American people until very, very late supported the Vietnam War, and they thought that the young, mostly college people that opposed it were simply traitors. It was very, very difficult to overcome that. You had the Reagan Democrats. You had construction workers, the hard hats, right, who beat up anti-war protesters because to them it was, you know, this was anti-patriotic. I mean, the thinking didn't go beyond that. And people that should have been natural allies, right? So, according to socialists, anyway, the students and blue collar workers should be natural allies against the, you know, owners of corporations and so forth. And it didn't work out that way because of basically nationalism, right? The United States, you know, America. God bless America, wave the flag, and so forth. It moved more people than the idea that there was the brotherhood of the working class.
I think that Americans of our fathers and grandfathers generation, some of whom were professional military, never even conceived that America would have a wrong war. So that was an issue then. What now? Why are we seeing a revival? We talked about it earlier. We have Bernie Sanders calling himself a democratic socialist. There's two things I see going on, Bill, and maybe you can address this for us. There's the new left, like the Democratic Socialists, doing their things. And there's this mass movement against Trumpism and far-right Republican. When people realized that they were going to actually take away their medical insurance, they really freaked out. And the pressure kept it from happening. So how is the opposition to the whole Trump administration and the conservative and the manipulations that conservative Republicans are doing, like basically trying to privatize our public lands, kind of theft in my point of view. But how is that different, the populist movement from, is there a new left that's separate?
Well, yes. Yes, there is. I mean, socialism is back out of the closet again. This seems to go in cycles, right? It was a dirty word for so long because it meant Stalin, right? It meant our enemy. It meant the creeping red terror. It meant, you know, fighting them over there and fighting them over here. And there was just no way to talk about socialism in an environment like that because Stalin was the only socialist that anybody really knew about, right? And nobody, or Mao, you know, there were two of them. And then later Castro. So there's just no way to call yourself a socialist. The reason why it's back out of the closet again is really very simple. When things are going well, that period of prosperity from the end of World War II, when all this pent-up demand and all of these young people coming back from overseas after 4 years, we didn't have any work for them, so we gave them free college. Wow. We had a huge housing boom because there was no place for them. They were getting married and having kids, and there was no place for them to live, right? And the country just absolutely boomed. Wages went up. Unions were very strong. Prosperity. How could a socialist argue that capitalism destroyed the working class when the working class was making out like bandits? Two cars, you know, a new house, a refrigerator, television. I mean, auto workers were making $25 an hour with full health care and my pension. $25 an hour in 1960 was a lot of money.
And this is when there's a 90, the country is booming and there's, Bill can probably tell me the exact figure, but there's a 90% tax on income. So a guy making millions and millions and millions of dollars is gonna see a deep cut in his income, and yet everything is expanding anyway.
Yeah, well, that's the marginal tax rate. That's not the tax on his entire income. That's the tax on his income above a certain amount. That's, but yeah, it would be viewed by most people now, even poor people, it would be viewed as a confiscatory tax. But what it did was it funded social programs that made life easier for everybody and therefore made the political environment more egalitarian. Right. I mean, my father used to say something to me a lot when when we'd encounter somebody who was, you know, being snooty to us, rich person or a clerk, you know, in a bureaucracy or something, my dad would say to me, he said, you know what? He puts his pants on the same way I do, one leg at a time. That was a very American sentiment, which is, I'm just as good as you are. And never mind how much I make, right? Because I'm an American citizen, you know, and I work for a living, you know. I earn my keep. That was his attitude.
It's been turned into sort of something else, hasn't it? I mean, that's part of the rhetoric we're seeing. So what are democratic socialists trying to answer? What is the central problem right now that they're trying to face?
Well, the central problem is that prosperity and America's leadership in the world ended about 1970. The fact that, you know, America produced most of the world's goods and collected most of the world's profits disappeared gradually over the 70s and 80s as the Japanese began to sell more cars in the United States than Ford, and the Germans and the French began to assert foreign policy differences with the United States, despite, you know, France left NATO under de Gaulle. And went their own way. Germany, Willy Brandt, who was a socialist prime minister of Germany, developed something he called Ostpolitik, that is, politics of the East, and began to negotiate with representatives of the Soviet republics independently of the United States. This was a huge scandal. He had been the mayor of Berlin, you know, and had seen what kind of diplomacy that he had to exert in order to keep the Russians out of West Berlin. And he learned to deal with the Russians, and he thought we ought to deal with them. And the United States said no, so he went his own way. So the American hegemony, that is to say American control of the world's politics and economics, begins to erode. That's quite natural. I mean, you can't run everything forever. Human beings aren't built that way.
And we have new countries rising now. China, people at one point were talking about Brazil. Brazil now had a lot of difficulty. But Brazil was coming up. Countries in the Middle East began to assert themselves. But what I'm asking, Bill, is what's the central problem now that's causing the organization to triple its size and for people to, I understand why people are not afraid to talk about socialism. I think that's a really good point. But why are they interested in this given the fact that the country's doing pretty well?
Well, the country isn't doing pretty well, first of all. The echoes of 2007, 2008 are still all around us. I mean, and the problem is that we used to think that the Republicans were the party of business and the Democrats were the party of the working class, the working people, right? The little guy. I mean, some of these guys who voted for Trump, their grandfathers had pictures of FDR above their fireplace, right next to a portrait of John L. Lewis, who was the head of the United Mine Workers Union, right, in West Virginia. I'm talking about the Trump voters in West Virginia. And they've forgotten all of that. Why? Well, because the Democrats essentially, in order to preserve their electoral majority, got into bed with the same people that or went after the same people that the Republicans are going after, that is to say the wealthy. They needed a lot of money to run elections. So how can you believe, for example, that Hillary Clinton is a friend of the working class when she gives a speech to Goldman Sachs and collects $250,000 for it, and you still can't get affordable health care, or they just closed the plant or the mine, and nobody seems to be interested in that. Nobody except Michael Moore is gonna carry the water of those people who lost all their jobs in what we now call the Rust Belt of the 80s. So, you know, they look around, who's for us? And then here comes this billionaire real estate shyster from New York and says, me, I got a baseball cap that's going to make America great again. I'm on your side. Well, yeah. But if you look at his administration, there's as many Goldman Sachs financiers in his administration as there was in the Obama administration or the Clinton administration before it. So the sense that people have is these people are all in bed together, right? And they're not on our side. And then you look at, you know, how about somebody who's working for $10 an hour in a Walmart or Amazon fulfillment center with no air conditioning and whose schedule, well, this week you may have 10 hours of work, next week you may have 40, week after that you may have 70. We don't need you today, don't come in. You know, that.
So what will, I guess my question, or turning to it again, is, well, a little bit different. What does the, if there's a new left, there's this broad movement against Trumpism, and there's, when people realize the Republicans, at least on health care, are really going to take it away from people, they rebelled. 17% of the people supported the Republican. They had no support for it at all. They kept voting for it because they're like Republicans, but they had no support. But that hasn't really shifted to understanding other issues. So there's a movement against Trump and the right wing, but it seems to me that a new left, this is just my opinion, has to offer alternative strategies and ideas as well as criticisms of bad stuff going on.
Yeah, well, we talked about socialism's roots in the past. Why then, and its defeats? Why then do so many young people think it's a viable posture to address the future? Why has socialism come out of the closet? Why are all of these people who supported Bernie in the United States or Corbyn in Britain, why all of a sudden are they willing to call themselves socialists and campaign for social justice as open socialists? Well, the answer is that it's pretty clear that if we rely on free market capitalism and globalization to take care of our needs, we're going to be sadly disappointed because, first of all, it's pretty clear that they're not investing in a real economy that puts people to work. What they're doing is they're running a casino, right? That's what all these derivatives are about. They can get higher yields by swapping paper back and forth than they can. It's a risky to build a factory because you don't know whether you invest all this money, you don't know whether you're going to be able to sell what comes out of it.
Huge fortunes are made by manipulating the money stream, not by building things. Yeah. So somebody like Steve Jobs builds computers. But most of the money that we're seeing, including Romney when he ran, is made by manipulating the money stream. It doesn't seem to produce much, but except for wealth for the people involved in it.
It produces no social benefit at all. In fact, it's a disinvestment. It takes money out of the real economy. What do you think this privatization stuff is all about? Right? You're taking a public utilities, things like schools and jails and roads and whatever have you, even parking meters in some cities, which used to be run by a government which was paid for by our tax revenue and whose only purpose was to provide efficient operation of these public utilities. You take that away from them and hand it over to a donor to your campaign, and he runs it as a profit center. And he sucks all of the money that you would invest in better jails or better food for prisoners or a better education. He sucks it out of the economy, and what does he do? He invests in emerging economy derivatives.
So the new left then would oppose the whole process of privatization of public utilities and spaces. The interesting question that you raised, I hadn't really thought about, was why this sudden push to privatizing? They're seeking profits in things that were public utilities, public ownership.
Instead of taking the risk to produce new products, what they're doing is they're using government programs as cash mines. They're taking the money away from the people and putting it in their pockets by telling the people that they can run these operations more efficiently than the government can. And that's is proving to be nonsense. Now, one of the reasons, and another reason why so many young people are willing to be call themselves socialists these days, is that whenever things are not going very well, and things are not going very well, no matter what the employment statistics tell you, and I could go into that in great detail, but it's not essential to the argument. But things, let's just, you know, take it for granted for a moment that things are not going very well and that everybody knows it, right? I mean, one thing capitalism is very good at is production. What it's not very good at is distribution, right? And it gets worse. The more power you put in the hands of people with a lot of money, the worse it's going to get. But what happens is when things are going really bad, what do? You go up in the attic and you rummage around in grandma's old trunk that she left up there to see if there's any ideas out of past history that addressed the situation that you think has gone south on you. And it just so happens that socialism, that is putting some brakes on billionaires, right, and taking things away from them and redistributing them to areas where you think better investments could be made in our common future. I mean, you know, if we need something like the Hoover Dam or the Interstate Highway System, don't think for a moment that Apple or Bain Capital is going to build it for you. The only people who can build it for you is the government. But you can't have a highly functioning economy if you don't provide those public goods. And if all that your government, your captured legislators are telling you is that we got to cut taxes, you're going to wind up being a third world country. And this is something that socialism was well aware of 200 years ago. And that's why people have dug it out of grandma's trunk and brought it downstairs and said, hey, look at this. Maybe these guys from Goldman Sachs, something can be done about it. Maybe we can pry this money away and put it to better use.
So there's very different takes, I guess, among democratic socialists. I've been reading about what to do and what to focus on. But the thing is, they're willing to look at ideas that I think other people are not, is that fair to say, are not as focused on? Because it's very similar to, you know, the Bernie movement in a lot of ways.
Well, they're looking to the future. I mean, one of the things that was so good about Marx, despite what you've been told, is that he looked at the economic relationships that were fostered under capitalism. He said technology determines the form of society. And if you look forward to things that we've discussed on the show before, like artificial intelligence and the decline in employment that results from it, and, you know, and big data and mass surveillance and all these other factors, these are the technologies that are going to govern the shape of our future, and the young people that are looking at socialism as a solution to these problems are not just looking back. They're looking ahead to this new society that so far our politicians haven't addressed.
I think there's a little bit, but the real problem of automation, Bill, I think is something that you brought up that almost nobody's been talking about and bringing. It needs to be bring to the forefront. Somebody needs to be honest about what's happening with automation.
Not to mention global warming and 1,000 military bases spread all over the world and $1 trillion on a war in Iraq.
Well, I think it's interesting that we're seeing a revival of a very old movement, a new rhetoric, and I think that it's going to take millions of people thinking about what to do, from conservatives to socialists to Democrats, to figure out what to do about the country, because we're in a crisis.
Thank you for being with us on Democratic Perspective. Visit our website, vvid.org. We're glad to have you folks visit. You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and our nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 a.m. news and our Saturday replay after the noon news right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.